And then, of course, thank you to Muscoe, who firmly Ryan, who has been a good friend of the Federal Society for a number of years. Are there any other housekeeping announcements that need to be made before we move on? Okay. Then let's start with the first panel. I am not only greeting you, I am moderating the first panel. So the first panel this morning will involve the scope of the franchise 2008. It is a panel that we put together to consider the regulation, qualification, and registration of voters and voting. Now, I come from across the river. In particular, I teach at George Mason Law School, which is in what is now called, I guess, the communist country of Arlington County, according to McCain campaign, right, or certain spokespersons. But I don't live in Arlington. I live in Fairfax County, which, like Lake Wobegon, is above average in every respect. Counties are important. Counties are still the front lines of election administration and are the prime deliverers of the service of holding elections. And they have been ever since the state has been as involved as it has been in holding elections, which hasn't been from time immemorial, but really more or less from the advent of the Australian ballot. Now, election administration has been, for a lot of this time, a relatively quiet backwater in election law. To the extent that there were recounts or questions about regularity in elections, various jurisdictions developed sort of a common law of how they would be handled. The feeling was this was very ad hoc practice. I remember one time being asked to represent a client in a recount at a county level in California, where I was told, you know, there really aren't any rules here. Just go down and, you know, look fierce and make sure they don't try and pull anything. Okay. And I went down and looked as fierce as I possibly could. And I don't think they pulled anything, and so I consider that a win. But this is the point. There's an ad hoc and a common law in place on how things would be handled. But that's not the case anymore. Election administration is a hot topic and becoming more regularized all the time. A lot of that has to do, as I'm sure you're well aware, with the 2000 presidential election, where we saw essentially a tie and what things crawl out from under the rocks when you get that close. The federal mandates from Hobbs followed from that. But there are also other sort of demographic things at work that I think we're thinking about. The volunteer generation that we depended on run precincts in many places is going away. I'm not sure that we need a social commitment to figuring out how we're going to replace them. The level of public investment in a slowing economy in election administration is something I think we need to think about. And in places with large population flux, the concern is now and continues to be who's voting. Now, there's two parts to the who's voting question. The more abstract one is, who do we decide is qualified to vote? And who is an elector? A definition has become broader over time as we've expanded on the notion of voting as a fundamental right. But there's a particular question, too, that has become part of the current debate because of the Crawford litigation. Who is the person in front of me? Not, are they qualified, but are they who they say they are? Or who is the person attached to his absentee ballot? Not so much are they qualified, qualifications not being that part of the hurdle anymore. Are they the person that they're supposed to be? So it's gone from a notion that electors sort of representative of a larger community to a notion that an elector and a citizen should be largely determinist. But even today, we don't literally apply that. And so, as you know, the restrictions on voting by felons differ from state to state. The restrictions on voting and what is incapacity differ from state to state. States still have some discretion, though not nearly the discretion they had in the last century, on who gets to be an elector and who gets to vote. As the franchise is broader and more people are brought into it, and our society becomes more complicated and more mobile, concern about, you know, who is that person and is that person qualified is a harder question to answer. And the government starts taking a more active role in trying to elucidate norms for this. So as we listened to the panelists this morning, I'm hoping that we could talk about whether the perfect is the enemy of good, to what degree these answers are resolvable by overriding laws, whether or not more localized approaches need to be taken. Are we struggling just to get to good? To say nothing of the perfect being the enemy of good. Now, I would like to introduce our speakers today. First off the bat will be Mr. Doug Kellner. Douglas Kellner has served as co-chair of the New York State Board of Elections since 2005. Before moving to the New York State Board, Doug Kellner served as the commissioner on the New York City Board of Elections from 1993 to 2005. Commissioner Kellner has been an outspoken advocate for improving the voting process in New York while insisting on transparency, verifiability, accuracy, and uniformity in voting procedures. Commissioner Kellner is a partner in the law firm of Kellner, Hurley, Getty, and Friedman. He served as the chairman of the New York County Lawyers Election Law Committee, and is a member of the Election Law Committee of the Association of the Bar of the City of New York. He serves on the advisory boards of the Accurate Voting Foundation and the Verified Voting Foundation. Mr. Kellner will be going first. He will be followed by David Mulhouse. David is a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation Center for Data Analysis and an adjunct professor of public policy at George Mason. Mulhouse's recent research has focused on the impact of voter ID laws on voter turnout. His research strongly indicates that voter ID laws have little to no effect on voter turnout. The legislative committees from Kansas and Texas have sought Mulhouse's expert testimony on voter ID laws. Mulhouse came to Heritage, who was staff of the Senate Judiciary Committee, where he specialized in crime and juvenile justice policy. Before that, he served as manager of a juvenile correction facility in Baltimore. He holds a doctorate degree in public policy from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and a bachelor's degree in political science and justice studies from Prosper State University. Following David will be Wendy Weiser. Wendy directs the Brennan Center's work on voting rights and elections. She's authored a number of reports and papers on election reform, litigated groundbreaking voting rights lawsuits, and provided health policy and legislative drafting assistance to federal and state legislators and administrators across the country. She's a frequent public speaker and media contributor on election reform issues. In fact, I first met her on radio. She's also an adjunct professor of law at NYU School of Law. And then finally, we will wrap up our panel this morning with some remarks by Hans Bukowski. Hans is presently a visiting scholar at the Heritage Foundation, where he has authored a series of studies on voting and election issues. Prior to that, he was a commissioner on the Federal Election Commission, and prior to that, he was with the U.S. Department of Justice as an assistant attorney general for civil rights from 2002 to 2005. Hans has a wide range of experience in election-related issues and has published widely in a variety of media. Now, the ground rules are these. Each panelist, in the order that I've introduced them, will have 8 minutes to give you whatever knowledge they feel they need to give you uninterrupted by me or their fellow panelists. After those 8 minute statements, I will direct questions at the panel generally in whatever ad hoc way I decide works best. And after we do a bit of that and things have drawn to stalemate, we will open it up to audience questions. And certainly we will give you guys at least a half hour, if not more, for questions from the audience, because that's usually where the fun lies. So without further ado, fellas, I don't know if you want to sit there or if you want to stand. Either way, it's fine with me.
So good morning. When we deal with elections, I think it is helpful to start with what I regard as the four key principles of election administration. The first is accuracy, that the whole point of election administration is to be counting the votes, and it's not just vote counting, but the whole administration of the process that needs to be accurate, because people are voting who shouldn't be voting, then that affects the accuracy of the result, and the same is also true if people who should be voting are not able to vote. The second is uniformity. You want to make sure that whatever rules you apply are being applied the same way across the board so that there's no discrimination. And that can be more difficult than it seems, because there's so many situations where, as all lawyers, you can differentiate the situation and say, well, it really is uniform because of this exception or that exception. But striving for uniformity should be a key principle of election administration. The third principle that is very important is transparency, because the key for trusting the outcome of the of an election is to make sure that it's transparent, that everybody can see exactly how the result was accomplished. And it's very important that in each element of election administration that election administrators think about, well, how do we do this in a way that everybody can see what's going on and see how the decisions are being made and have confidence in the result. And finally, I stress that there should be verifiability, that you should be able to work backwards and verify that each of these other principles, accuracy, uniformity, and transparency, did in fact occur. And there are five main areas of election administration where these principles need to be applied. First is registration, who is entitled to vote. The second is ballot access, how do we determine who gets on the ballot. The third is the voting process itself, how the vote is cast. Then the fourth is the counting of the vote, the canvass process by which the votes are aggregated and the result is determined. And then in recent years, there's a fifth area that has been added to election administration duties, and that's campaign finance disclosure. And again, providing for accuracy, uniformity, transparency, and verifiability in campaign finance disclosure is sometimes more difficult than it seems. Certainly the amount of litigation on campaign finance disclosure shows what a difficult problem it is. Now, in addressing these, I think it's worthwhile to take a few minutes to just review the history of voting, because it's an area that so few people understand just how profoundly different voting is today from the time when our Constitution was developed more than 200 years ago. At the time our Constitution was written, first of all, relatively few people had the right to vote, as Allison mentioned. But the process itself was also very different. You had to show up and attend the meeting where the votes were taken. Voting was done basically at a town level in the northern states that relied on town government, or on a county level in the southern states that relied on county government. And you went to the county seat or to the town hall and had to show up at the meeting. And given the transportation system two centuries ago, that was a major undertaking. Most elections also were done by unanimity. Somebody would say, okay, who are we going to send off to the legislature? Somebody would volunteer, and that person would most often be elected by acclamation. In the few contests that I have researched in New York colonial history, where there actually were contests, elections generally were an all-day affair. People would gather at the county seat, and the way they actually voted was by lining up in pairs, that the way they vote in the English Parliament today, so that there would be a line for each candidate, and the sheriff would record the vote publicly as they paired off, and whoever ended up having the longer line would win the election. Obviously, there was no secret ballot at all. Now, ballots became Massachusetts was the first state to introduce the ballot. Why did they do that? Because in Massachusetts, the General Assembly meant just what it said. Everyone who had the right to vote was to show up in Boston at the Capitol and was a member of the Assembly. That became unworkable relatively early on, and the way they got around that was by, in effect, having proxies, that you would show up at a town meeting, hand your proxies to somebody from the town who would then go to Boston to show up in the General Assembly, and that proxy, in effect, became the ballot. And that was the evolution, right? By the time the Constitution was written in 1787, there was no uniform system throughout the country by which people voted. And so if you look at the Federalist Papers, you see that there was some debate as to how they should go about making a uniform system of voting, and they decided against doing that. And the only provisions in the Constitution were that Congress would be able to set the time, place, and manner for electing the representative to the House of Representatives. And that power had not been invoked for many years other than to just set the date for holding the election for members of Congress. Similarly, presidential elections are really matters for the states, that the Constitution gives the state legislatures the sole discretion on how to provide for the election of the members of the Electoral College. And the only exception to that is that Congress gets to set the date for the election of the electors and the date for when the electors meet. So the evolution of this process, when people voted in the 19th century, as ballots became the method of voting, the reason they did ballots was because when people met at the town meeting, the town clerk would report the results to the Capitol, but often the town clerk would simply report a unit ballot. So if there were 100 eligible electors in the town, they would meet, decide who they were going to vote for, and then the town clerk would simply report 100 votes for whoever won that election without breaking them down. And so states began to require that there actually be ballots at these town meetings so that they could determine, first of all, did everybody actually show up and vote, and secondly, what was the actual breakdown of the votes so that they could be aggregated statewide. The government did not print the ballots. People had to provide their own written ballots, and this evolved into the system of passing out tickets. In New York, which was one of the early places where this developed, local civic organizations would decide on a list of candidates, print out a ticket, and pass that out to voters as they went in to vote, and the voters could then just simply put the ticket into the ballot box. And those local organizations then developed a great deal of power because they were passing out tickets and their candidates would be likely elected. In New York, the lodge known as the Tammany Society became the most effective at doing this, and the Tammany Society joined with other lodges, and that's how the Democratic Party was organized in New York as they developed. Problems with that system led to the Australian ballot, the secret ballot printed by the government. Now, like all good reforms, the problems that developed as soon as you have the government printing the ballots, then you have to decide how do you get names on the ballot, and that developed a whole new business of litigation over who gets access to the ballot. Since my time is coming to a close, let me just run very quickly into the issues of keeping perspective as we analyze who should have the right to vote with our registration process. The issue here is that there is some fraud. In my years, both as an election lawyer, as an election administrator, I have run across numerous cases of fraud. The problem, though, on the other side, is that do we throw the baby out with the bathwater? Right now, we have a registration system that is expensive to operate and, in effect, prevents many more people from voting than the number of fraudulent cases that are prevented by it. And I would say the ratio is probably more than 1,000 to 1. In other words, we prevent 1,000 people from having their votes cast and counted for every ballot that every potential fraudulent ballot that we prevent. And that we have to be very careful in balancing the costs and benefits of a system that discourages voting. And the other side also is that we should be looking at the costs of election administration. One of the examples I talk at is that in the 1980s, we found that there were cases of fraud where people were intercepting ballots going to nursing homes. So now we send inspectors to canvass nursing home ballots rather than allowing them to vote with free absentees. But the cost now of every nursing home ballot has risen from an average of $15 per voter to $75 per voter. So is that expenditure a worthwhile expenditure? In passing the Help America Vote Act, Congress mandated that all voting equipment provide access for the disabled. My estimate is that in New York, it costs about $3,000 per disabled voter in order to comply with that statute. Is that money that's well spent? The mission may have been a good idea, but the question is, have we really looked at the cost versus the benefit that we get out of that? And in my last point, Allison raised the issue of poll workers, and that is, to me, one of the most critical decisions that we have to look at going forward, because we no longer have this huge volunteer base. And as we make our election laws more and more complicated, my experience is that the greatest number of problems in election administration come from inadequately trained poll workers on what has become an overly complex system. So how do we reduce the complexity of the system, or how do we, how much are we going to invest in adequate training and staffing for our polls?
First off, I'd like to thank everybody for attending today. My name is David Mulhausen. I'm from the Heritage Foundation. So the question I'm going to ask is, do voter ID laws reduce voter turnout? And I'm going to be looking at this from a perspective of a social scientist. And overall, Americans appear to overwhelmingly adopt voter ID laws? Well, one of the first arguments in the case for advocating voter ID laws is it's a common sense solution to help prevent in-person voter fraud. It also helps strengthen the public's faith in the legitimacy of elections. Some argue that it may actually increase turnout. Also, it helps ensure that every qualified vote counts. Legal votes are not watered down by illegal votes. Americans, we see, overwhelmingly support voter ID laws. There are several polls done recently after the Supreme Court decision on the Indiana case, and about 69% of whites approved of such laws, 58% of African Americans, and 66% of other minorities. Another poll done about the same time found that 80% of Americans overall approved, while only 13% said no. So at least from this perspective, I think there's ample evidence that the public supports the notion of voter ID laws. Now, you're going to hear arguments that obtaining photo ID is problematic. Well, I would say it's not a problem, and often when it is a problem, the magnitude is drastically overstated. A survey by American University of voters in Indiana, Maryland, and Mississippi found that only 1.2% of respondents lack a government-issued photo ID, with less than 0.3% in Indiana, less than 2% in Maryland, and about 1.3% in Mississippi. And even more importantly, less than 0.5% neither had a photo ID nor citizenship documentation, such as a birth certificate, passport, and so forth. So most Americans, or majority of Americans, have voter ID law or have a photo ID or the proper identification to get a photo ID. Now, in 2006, a report published by the Eagleton Institute actually was submitted to the Election Assistance Commission, and it looked at various state voter ID laws in 2004. And it used a very common government survey called the Current Population Survey. And the Current Population Survey basically, it tells us our unemployment rates, it tells us information about the income of Americans, education backgrounds. And it's a rolling survey done every month. And in November, they asked you if you were registered a voter and did you vote in the last election. And this study, it found that states with stronger voter ID laws, turnout was lower. And so you had the New York Times, USA Today, and other major newspapers saying how, big headlines, how this report found that photo ID laws, photo ID laws reduced turnout. And so what I did was, after reading the study, I attempted to replicate its finding. All this data was publicly available. Anybody can get the data they used. And what I found is that much of the effect they found disappeared, and for often simple reasons. First of all, the authors used what was called a one-tailed significance test. And commonly in most science disciplines, you would use a two-tailed two-tailed statistical test. And I explained that in my paper that was given out to everybody. Also, Arizona and Illinois were incorrectly classified. For instance, Arizona was, in the Eagleton study, was classified as a non-photo ID state when it was in 2004 that they had it was on their election ballot, a statewide referendum on whether or not they would adopt the law. It was actually a signed name state, where you just have to go in and sign your name. And also, some of the variables, if you change how they control for the marital status, the results disappear, so the results were not robust. And so what I found with my colleague was that in photo ID states, respondents were just as likely to report that they voted compared to states where you just have to go in and say your name. Say, I'm David Miles, I'm here to vote, names on the list, and here we go. So there's no decrease. Also, same held true for African Americans and Hispanics. Now, well, I did find some negative relationships, but in fact they are so small that it's sort of very little policy significance. For instance, white respondents in photo ID states were about 2,000% less likely to say they voted, compared to states that required only individuals to state their name. African Americans, the decrease was 1/100% decrease. So these effects were really small. Now, since then, since my study has come out, there's a study by Professor Milio at the University of Missouri. And this is a very important study because it analyzed the change in voting turnout in Indiana from the 2002 and 2006 elections. So it's directly sort of testing the change in voting turnout between before the photo ID law was required or was implemented. And it found that actually statewide turnout increased by 2 percentage points in the election where photo ID laws was in effect. And there was no effect on turnout in counties that had higher concentrations of minorities, poor, elderly, or less educated, the groups are supposedly going to be most harmed by photo ID laws. And turnout increased in Democratic counties. Another study is actually particularly good by the University of Delaware, Professor Mykoff. He looked at elections from 2000 to 2006 and using some very good statistical techniques found that voter ID laws do not affect voter turnout. So I just want to conclude and say that it appears from the social science literature that voter ID laws do not suppress voter turnout. And these laws are, you know, I think are a common sense solution to help resolve a problem of in-person voter fraud, and they do not have the huge negative impact that opponents claim.
Thank you very much. I think I'm going to stay seated, and it's a real pleasure to be here. I know that we don't all agree on all policy issues, but I think it's great for people of good faith who might have different views to try and sit down and solve what we all agree or some an electoral system that's in real need of some modernization and reform. I'm going to focus today on a category of voting problems that we're seeing a lot of lately, and one that I think as lawyers you should appreciate, and that's the rise of new technical barriers to voting. And I'm going to make the, I believe, non-controversial argument that these kinds of technical barriers have no place in fair election administration. I'll talk a little bit more about other voter registration problems and a solution that I think helps solve those problems. Sure. Thank you. And I'll talk also about a policy solution that I hope solves those problems and perhaps some of the concerns of my co-panelists as well. So I'll start with the technical barriers. Last week, the Ohio Supreme Court reversed a decision by the Secretary of State to reject thousands of absentee ballot applications filed by registered voters whose eligibility wasn't in serious doubt. And the disclosure, we did finally brief in that case. And the reason those were rejected was because the voters didn't check a box that was on the application. And I want to just describe this in some detail because it does illustrate the kinds of problems that we're seeing across the nation. The box in question, which looked like a bullet point, was at the top of the voter registration form, the absentee ballot request form. It was the form that was created by the McCain campaign. And it was right next to a sentence that said, I'm a qualified elector and I would like to receive an absentee ballot for the November 4th, 2008 election. And most readers would interpret the act of filling out and signing the form as a contract statement, and that, in fact, is how thousands of Ohio citizens and mostly elderly citizens interpreted the form, but that's not how the Secretary of State interpreted the form. According to her, if the voter didn't check that little bullet point box, then he didn't affirm his qualifications, and therefore his application had to be rejected. And so, putting aside the fact that the voters actually had clearly intended to indicate that they are qualified, you know, that kind of statement is plainly unnecessary for election officials to determine voter eligibility. The voters not only included on the form all their registration information, but the Secretary of State actually has a database of all qualified electors in the state who are registered and could very easily check out each of their qualifications. So this is really just a game of gotcha, and this is the kind of thing that we're seeing across the country. Fortunately, the Ohio Supreme Court did step in and order those on applications processed, and those thousands of voters can now vote absentee. But courts aren't always around or willing to overturn every technical hurdle set up for voters, and we're seeing a lot of them. In Florida and a number of other states, they have a really similar rule for processing voter registration applications. If voters don't check the HAVA checkboxes, asking voters to confirm that they're a citizen at over 18, then the state doesn't process the form, even though later on the form, the voters give their birth dates and they sign a sworn statement that they're a citizen and eligible to vote. And that's the law in Florida. It's been actually not only upheld by courts, but it's already led to the rejection of thousands of voter registrants, and they were unable to vote in the elections in 2004 and 2006 was rejected. A similar kind of barrier that we're seeing crop up across the country. four states currently have a rule in place that they will not add new voters to the rolls unless states can electronically match their new voter registration information against information in Social Security and driver's license databases. And in fact, right now, there are recently filed lawsuits in three other states seeking to impose this requirement retroactively on voters that have registered in those states. And this sounds like an innocuous procedure, perhaps an identity check. But the real problem here is that the state databases that they're checking are filled with errors. And in Florida, for example, one study shows the database has 40 different spellings of Fort Lauderdale, the state's second largest city. And the match processes that are being used are widely acknowledged, including by the National Academies of Science, as error-prone, to say the least. To give a sense of the magnitude of the errors, Florida recently started processing or examining 20,000 match failures that it received over the past few weeks since it started implementing this policy. And it has already found that 75% of those are the result of typos. And it's still going through the rest to see whether those are erroneous failed matches as well. And in Wisconsin, one of the states where there's a lawsuit trying to push through this policy, an audit of the state database found that 22% of the voters on that database didn't match, including four of the six members of the Government Accountability Board, which is the election board in Ohio, in Wisconsin. So that it is another technical barrier that's keeping eligible voters who have, who through no fault of their own, off the rolls and therefore unable to cast ballots on the count. And the Brennan can actually examine these match problems and actually found that they impact African American, Asian American, people with foreign-sounding names, and married women actually at much higher rates than other voters. So that's another real problem. And these kinds of technical barriers do highlight a vulnerability in the system and one which I believe we should address, and that's that it's vulnerable to, the system can be gamed to keep out eligible voters, voters that you think aren't going to vote the way you want, and in fact it does keep out many eligible voters, typically for no fault of our own. And this obviously is not new to electoral politics. Back in the Jim Crow days, these kinds of technical barriers were very frequent and typically ill-intentioned. But regardless of the intention, these kinds of barriers are still unfair and frankly, have no place in the legal system of elections. And Congress actually, back in the 60s, passed a law prohibiting the use of immaterial paperwork errors or omissions to deny people the right to vote, and I think that we have a renewed commitment to that principle. But getting rid of paperwork obstacles isn't an option. We still do have a system where 30%, at least according to the 2006 census, of Americans still aren't registered, and paperwork problems accounts for only a fraction of that. Other problems involve bad list maintenance practices. The Brennan Center recently released a report showing that across the country, there are millions of people being purged. Obviously, the voter rolls need to be purged regularly, but it's being done in a process that has no notice for voters in an ad hoc basis from county to county, using error-prone processes that are similarly prone to manipulation. And that's one example of this is one Mississippi local election official discovered that one of his colleagues earlier this year had erroneously purged 10,000 voters from the rolls using her home computer. There are access problems as well. I'm sure many of you have read about the controversies involving the Department of Veterans Affairs not allowing voter registration. Voter registration drive, civic groups, or even election officials, the ability to provide voter registration services to the residents and patients of those facilities, and the department itself wasn't providing those, only a few hundred of the 5.2 million patients in its facilities were registered through their CRM, and so that's obviously an unacceptable situation. And so all this points to a need, I believe, to modernize our voter registration system. The system we currently have in place was has been virtually unchanged since it was first implemented in the late 19th century. And I think we can all agree on the ultimate goal, which is a system in which every eligible voter is included. They're included only once, and only eligible voters are included, and a system that is not vulnerable to manipulation or gaming for partisan any other purposes. And I'm hopeful that we can all agree on the direction forward. And we believe that that direction is moving towards a system of universal voter registration, which election officials actually take responsibility for building a list of eligible voters and only eligible voters. And that can be done automatically using existing government lists that are actually more complete than the voter registration rolls, like the state tax list, social service list, driver's license list, and by regularly checking for duplicates and people who've moved and died as well. And registration would then be permanent within states. People wouldn't have to re-register every time they move, and that's actually currently the case in at least 8 states. And there would also have to be some fail-safe procedures like election day registration or traditional voter registration for the about 9% or so of people that would be missed at this kind of process. And this is a system, a kind of system is used in most other advanced democracies, and it has a lot of advantages over what we're currently doing. One is cost, actually, but it also would include far more eligible voters than our current system does. It would dramatically reduce opportunities for imposing these kinds of technical barriers and for gaming the system. It would reduce the need for a huge administrative infrastructure to hand out and process voter registration applications. It would streamline and rationalize the process and eliminate the problem of election officials having to process hundreds of thousands of voter registration applications in a week before an election. It would eliminate actually opportunities for voter registration fraud, which I think many people in this room believe creates the risk of voter fraud. And it's actually wildly supported by American success. It can be easily implemented, especially with our new statewide voter registration databases. But whether or not we do pursue a system of universal voter registration, we do need reforms that eliminate the ability to game the system. An electoral system in which each side is spending time trying to knock off the voters that they think will vote for the other side, is one in which voters lose and voters win when and democracy wins and each side actually spends their time trying to win the voters. I'll leave it at that for now.
Thank you.
Well, if you don't mind, I'll follow Wendy's example and speak from here. Gosh, where to start? We covered a lot of material. I'm going to try to answer many of the questions that were outlined in the description of this, but then I'm also going to deal with a couple issues. David really covered the voter ID issue in destroying this myth out there that somehow voter ID is tough for people to meet and that it depresses turnout. Let me put a period on that by doing two things. He was talking about social science studies. Let's look at what actually happened in Georgia and Indiana this year in their presidential preference primaries when the photo ID laws were in full force and effect. Georgia had a record turnout of over 2 million voters. That's a million more than in 2004 when the photo ID law was not in effect. Voters who did not have an ID were less than 0.01%. The number of African-American Georgians who voted this year doubled over the 2004 primary, and there were 100,000 more votes cast in the Democratic primary than the Republican primary. Indiana also had record turnout. The turnout of Democratic voters quadrupled over 2004, and there were 862,000 more votes cast in the Democratic than the Republican primary. Now, you'll see a lot of things in your Times and Spot saying these voter ID laws are a plot by Republicans to suppress the vote. Well, if you take Georgia and Indiana, it's not working very well. I agree with a lot of what Doug said, but I have to disagree with one thing, and that is that the registration system we have today prevents people from voting. It's extremely easy to get registered to vote. You know, Motor Voter made it possible for you to get registered to vote at your DMV, when you go get your license, and that's how the vast majority of people get licensed, and with vote by mail registration, which voter voter required, you can pick up voter registration forms just about anywhere, fill them out, send them in, and you're registered to vote. There was a great book a couple of years ago. I didn't realize this subject would come up, so I don't have an exact title for it. There was a study that looked intensely at non-voters and went in and did surveys and in-depth interviews with people to find out why they didn't vote. The difficulty in the Petras survey was at the bottom of a long list. The top reason people weren't voting was, frankly, because they weren't interested in the elections and weren't voting. In fact, the largest percentage of group in the country that don't vote are, as you would expect, young people in their early, late 20s. And, you know, in the book, they kind of speculate that people, as they get older and get more ensconced in the community and start to take more of an interest in governing and politics, they start to vote more. But difficulty in registering was not a problem. One of the main questions is, you know, we have a federal system. To what degree should the state regulation of elections and franchise be preempted by Congress for making uniform rules? Well, we've got probably the most decentralized voting system in the world. You know, most other countries, Australia is an example, you know, they have a central election board that runs the elections. We don't have that. We've got 3,000 counties running our elections in the country. That's the way it's been throughout our history. And until 2002, it was the oldest unfunded mandate in our history, because Congress had never appropriated any money for them to regulate, to run elections. Now, we've obviously got some federal laws that govern this, the Voting Rights Act being the most important, which prevents discrimination in voting based on race. We also have another federal statute known as UACAVA, Uniform and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act, which guarantees the right federally of people in the military and overseas citizens to vote by absentee mail in federal elections. We also have voter-voter. The Help America Vote Act that was passed in 2002 was the first time, really, that Congress came up with a law that really got into deeply the administration of elections the way the states do it. I mean, for example, you know, one of its main requirements was requiring all states to put in a computerized statewide voter registration database, and there's a certain number of requirements it has to meet. And one of the things that HAVA required is something, and I don't want to pick on Wendy, but I have to, since the Brennan Center is deeply involved in all these. One of the things that Help America Vote Act required was that states, once they've set up these computerized voter registration databases, start doing data matching with other state databases. Now, the idea was that if somebody fills in a voter registration form and sends it in, one of the new things added was you're supposed to put on it your driver's license number. And what the state is supposed to do with that information is they check the driver's license number that you put on your voter registration form against DMV. And they see if the name and address that are in the DMV records match with the name and address on the voter registration form. Now, HAVA was a hotly debated law. There were a lot of compromises between the Democrats and Republicans to put it together. But they agreed that this was a necessary requirement. Why? Well, one of the problems with the voter-voter law was that with mail-in registration, you could fill out a form with a name and address, mail it in, and you became registered. And there was no check by election officials of any of the information on that form. And there are many, many examples of how that was used to steal elections. And I'll give you just a prime one. The Miami Herald won a Pulitzer Prize for its investigation of a 1997 mayoral race in Miami. The results were overturned because there were 5,000 fraudulent absentee ballots cast in that. One of the guys who was convicted in that case, and they arrested him, what did they find in his apartment? Well, they found a stack of mail-in voter registration forms, and they found a stack of absentee ballot request forms. And what he was doing was using the extraordinarily easy method of registering by mail to send in form after form after form with a false name. The people would get registered, and then he could request and vote by absentee ballot through that. So how to put in this requirement for data matching. The Brennan Center and other organizations have filed suits in Florida to prevent the states from doing that. Now, the states are not going to toss somebody off the rolls because the data is matched. The way the states have set up this process is if a form comes in to do data matching and there's a problem, they're going to contact the voter and try to find out what the discrepancy is. And if they can straighten it out, then they're going to get them registered. But it's pretty material if, you know, Joe Smith tries to register to vote, and when the DMV number is pulled up, it's not for Joe Smith, but it's for, you know, Susan Brown, and if the person lives somewhere else. And if you think voter registration fraud is not a problem, do a quick Google search on Acorn, and you'll find that there are a dozen investigations going on all over the country for voter registration fraud by this organization. And keep in mind, these are places where, when they were filling out the forms, they did a stupid job with them, and they were caught initially by the election officials. We don't know how many forms like that made it through the system. I don't think we should federalize and have Congress telling the states what their rules should be for registration and absentee voting. And I'll give you a couple of quick examples of this. The state of Oregon has gone to all-mail elections. You know, they don't have polling places open on Election Day. Do we really think that the senator from Oregon introduces a bill in Congress, because he thinks mail-in voting is a good thing, that we should force off the states to have to do that? Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea. I'll give you another example. In 2002, when the Help America Vote Act was being debated, one of the things Congress debated was, you know, the whole purpose of that was they wanted states to get rid of punch card ballot machines. And, you know, today, a lot of people have questions about electronic voting machines. You know, they're questioning the fact that they don't have paper trails. They're questioning the ability of the software to get hacked. The ACLU has filed suits in a number of states claiming that the use of electronic voting machines are a violation of constitutional rights. That was not the situation in 2002. In 2002, everyone thought and agreed that electronic voting machines were great. They were a terrific substitute to punch card voting machines. What if Congress had mandated in the Help America Vote Act that the entire country switch over to electronic voting machines? Well, we'd be in a heck of a lot worse situation today, where we have some states that switched over who now are trying to switch back to paper voting machines. I don't think that kind of federal mandate is the way to go. Same thing with same-day registration. The whole problem with same-day registration is it gives no time whatsoever for local election officials to check the validity and accuracy of the information contained on the voter registration form. And if you think that's not a problem, then I suggest you do a Google search. Do a quick Google search for a report put out by the Milwaukee Police Department, who put together a task force after the 2004 election. And one of the things they found, among many others, was that one of the presidential campaigns and a 527 organization who established offices in Wisconsin had dozens of their staffers who were brought in from out of state and who didn't live in Wisconsin but were only there to work on the election. They took advantage of the same-day registration law, registered and voted in the election. Now, the Wisconsin Police Department was very careful not to identify which presidential campaign it was and which 527 group, but they mentioned some of the staffers who did it, and from that, I was able to figure out from one of my Heritage papers that it was a Kerry campaign, and it was another organization called the Environmental Defense Victory. So, you know, people in those states have decided they want same-day registration. There are bills in Congress right now to force that on the rest of the country. Again, I don't think Congress has the right ability to do that. Finally, the idea of one of the issues we're supposed to deal with was extending the right to vote to ex-felons. That is purely up to each state to decide. The 14th Amendment specifically gives states the right to prevent felons from voting. There have been several bills introduced in Congress that would force the states to allow that kind of voting. Those are patently unconstitutional. There have been several lawsuits filed in different areas claiming that preventing felons from voting is a violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. That's a difficult argument to make, that you can use a congressional statute like that to override a constitutional provision. Those cases have lost, except, of course, in the Ninth Circuit, where the Ninth Circuit said that, yes, it could possibly be a violation of the Second Amendment. They sent it back to the district court, but the district court found no violation. There are other bills like that that are in Congress that would force various rules on voter registration and other issues on the states, many of which I think are unconstitutional because there are limits on the power of Congress, particularly with regard to state elections, being able to tell the states what to do. I probably haven't covered 100% of what I'd like to cover, but I'm out of time. So.
No, that's fine. Now it's my turn to ask some questions. Take the panelists and hear that they address you. So my first question is going to be for Doug. Hans mentioned the mandate in Congress for electronic voting machines. Here's an anecdote. I have a neighbor who votes in my precinct. She lives two doors down from me. Retired, nice lady, insists on casting a provisional ballot because she doesn't trust the machine. Can you comment on whether or not the mandate for electronic voting has improved public confidence in the voting process?
Well, just the opposite is that it raises big questions. An electronic voting system that does not have a voter verifiable paper audit trail is the equivalent of having ballots piled up into a ballot box and then asking a group of computer programmers to take those votes, count them in secret, tear up the ballots, and report the results. Because there's no way, it's not transparent and it's not verifiable. And the biggest problem with electronic voting is that you can steal elections on a grand scale. These problems with voter registration fraud are really very minor because it takes an incredible effort to marshal the kinds of votes that it would take in order to win an election through registration fraud. But when you have a centrally programmed voting system, you can transfer the ballots in a way that no one will ever know that the transfer has occurred. And it's a very difficult thing to do, but it's possible, and it completely destroys the confidence in the voting system. And so that's why I think that it's absolutely critical to have a voter verifiable paper audit trail if you're going to use an electronic device.
Okay, does anybody else want to weigh in on that? Yes, Hans.
I don't necessarily disagree, but I find it interesting, Doug, because you're coming from New York, and you're talking about having to have a paper verified an audit trail. Well, New York was the king of using Lever machines for I don't know how many years, and Lever machines are even worse than electronic voting machines and not having any kind of audit trail. The one thing I say about electronic machines is the idea that they're going to be easy to hack, I think, is not quite true, because the idea here is for an outside hacker to get into these machines, these machines are not networked. You know, you can't come up with a piece of software and spread it to a network into the thousands of electronic voting machines that are going to be put out in precincts. Each electronic voting machine is a standalone machine. So the only way you're going to be able to put some kind of virus or Trojan horse into the software as an outsider is if you do it. You can get into the warehouse and get into every single machine that's being used, or a large number. They're not networked machines. And despite all the claims about this, there's not been a single proven case that this has happened in any election. And you all may recall, we recently had a big election contest down in a congressional district in Florida, where there were claims that in fact the electronic voting machine must have been hacked because the election was so close. Three different teams of computer experts looked at those machines and the software, and their end conclusion of everybody was, there wasn't a problem there. There may have been one with the ballot design, which can happen almost from any time in the equipment.
I just wanted to quickly define it. We do have some extensive studies at the Brennan Center, and it's actually not the case that you need to get into each and every electronic voting machine in order to be able to insert malicious code that could spread among others, especially if you're using memory cards, or especially if you're going to, if you're inserting the code in the counting systems. And so that's just not the case. They are vulnerable. The reason why we don't know whether this has ever happened is that the majority of states that use this don't actually audit. Previously, nobody had audit trails. Now most states have some form of paper trail, but they don't audit those paper trails, so it's not of much use. And I'm not aware of any serious contentions that the Florida race was an electronic hacking job. I think that the ballot design was a serious problem. That's something else that I think that we're seeing nationwide, and that we can probably quite easily remedy. And we actually have some reports and train election officials on that as well.
Okay. Now, David, I want to follow up on your voter ID work. Not all voter ID laws are created equal. There are ID laws that are very specific in fact on, you know, who the issuing entity has to be. In Indiana, the state requires that there be an expiration date on the piece of identification, notwithstanding the fact that I was Allison Hayward 5 years ago and my ID is expired, I'm still probably Allison Hayward. I'll be over the expired ID. Have you been able to flesh out any differences in either turnout or public impression among these kinds of voter ID laws? Has your work touched on that at all?
Well, basically, my work has basically touched on the difference between saying, going to the polls, stating your name, giving a signature, providing a non-photo ID or a photo ID. So I think in depth, going beyond that, it's going to be a little more difficult to do, whether or not the state requires an expiration or not. But I think the states are going to have to muddle through with that. I think that there's one interesting case where, I'm just going to get to the exact points, but I was at a AARP policy council meeting, and they're talking about the case of Louisiana, whether or not they should have a photo ID law or some type of identification law. And one of the problems was is that a lot of the parishes did not keep birth certificates for a certain period of years. And so there was an old elderly population that may not have IDs and may not have birth certificates or their documentation because the documentation doesn't exist. It may have been lost. And so each state's going to have to tailor its law. If they choose to adopt a stricter requirement, they're going to have to tailor to the circumstances of the state. So I think that's something for the states to decide. And my recommendation for Louisiana would be if they want to adopt the photo ID law, maybe have a grandfather clause for the older generation didn't have. So then just going to have to, in some sense, muddle through and do the best they can.
Maybe you're smiling. I'm
going to
guess that you see misjudge in that tailoring process.
I'm trying to avoid talking about the photo ID requirement into responding to all of this. There's been much discussion on this, and I will add that there are a whole host of studies with different findings than the social science studies that actually show much different effects. And we do put them all on our website, regardless of their findings. One thing that amused me was the acknowledgement that there are different groups of people that might have different barriers getting different kinds of IDs, and I think that was something that the Supreme Court was struggling with in the Crawford case when it was thinking about whether, you know, what the scope of an as-applied or facial challenge to an ID requirement ought to be if the state hasn't done that kind of tailoring and adapting and so on. I think that's still an open question, and I'm sure we're going to see lots of litigation if you proliferate on that, but the unexactly dependent question.
Sure. Can I just say something? Very simple is that if we really believe in universal suffrage and that the only exceptions should be that people shouldn't vote if they're not citizens, and they shouldn't vote if they've been convicted of felonies. And everybody else should be entitled to vote. The burden really ought to be on the government, or the administrative agency, on why somebody who is presenting themselves to vote or to register should not be registering, instead of switching the burden around. Because right now, most of the people who are effectively denied their right to vote are denied their right to vote because of typographical errors and administrative errors by the voting agencies. And the number of people who are caught up in that is so many times greater than the problem we're trying to address. And the expense of keeping that system is also so many times greater than the problem we're trying to address. That you really do have to question why we're developing this complicated system that puts these burdens on the voter.
Any comments about that? Because I had a question for you, Wendy. We were talking about, and the panelists talked generally about cleaning up voter rolls, and you had some suggestions for best practices in how that might be done. What role do you see, if any, in the payment of bounties in the registration situation that we have now by private parties? Or by bounties, if you have to.
By bounties, I'm not aware. As far as I know now, there aren't any voter registration groups, at least nonprofit voter registration groups, that pay by the registration form anymore. I think that that's been, there's been a movement in a number of states recognizing that this increases the incentive for voter fraud to actually prohibit that, and I think that groups in states that aren't, that don't have such rules have voluntarily abandoned those practices, to recognizing the same thing, or at least to weigh public perception. But as far as I'm aware, this isn't something that's being done anymore. People are paid a salary to engage in voter registration and get out the vote, at least in the not-for-profit sector. I can't really speak to the political parties, but I do think that paying by the voter registration form does invite employees to perhaps inflate the number of forms that they're going to submit, and this is a problem in the early insurance law too. This is just not only in the voter registration context, and so I think that that's a reasonable regulation.
Yes, Hans.
We have to agree on that. But one of the worst things an organization has done in the past is pay a bounty. That means that they pay people for each voter registration form. That's one of the worst things that any organization can do. And unfortunately, it's not illegal in all states. Every state ought to pass a state law making that illegal. The problem is that even organizations that quit paying bounties have done something else sometimes. And I recently saw a story about an Acorn worker who had been arrested for voter registration fraud, submitting fraudulent forms. And while she wasn't being paid for form anymore by Acorn, she said in the interview, "Well, I had a quota." Well, that's just as bad. When they hire workers and give them a quota, you've got to get so many forms done, that has the same effect as paying a bounty. And that's something else that organizations should not do.
I agree that the quota is a problem. And, it's illegal in New York to pay for registration. It's also illegal on ballot access petitioning to pay petitioners per signature. And I think the courts should rule that if there's a quota on an hourly wage, that's the same thing, and that should also be illegal.
And then finally, Hans, I have a question for you. Again, with the problem with registration, Bert Hassan has suggested that registration be solely the responsibility of the government. I don't know that he's refined it to decide whether that government is state government or federal government, but how would you react to that, Russell?
Well, I have to disagree that on this idea that our registration system is so complex that it makes it difficult for people to register. That is just simply not the case. It's extremely easy for people to register.
The problem is it's easy to register, but the problem is it's not administered well. And so you have typographical errors that keep people from getting registered. In other words, they turn in the form, they did what they're supposed to do, but the form doesn't match because they
Well, what the states and the counties are doing in that situation is they're going back to the person, which is what they should do, and they're talking to the voter and they're getting it corrected. But this idea that people don't get to vote, look, in the last election, over 60% of the people who were eligible to vote in this country voted. It was the highest turnout we've had in almost 30 years. The main reason is people were really interested in that election. I think the chances are pretty good we're going to have that kind of high turnout again now. The problem with having the responsibility on the government, the only way I can see that you could do that is if you set up a national voter registration system and you passed a law and implemented it that required the issuance of a national voter registration card to every eligible American. And the problem with that is that people on both the political left and the political right would see that as a national ID, and the political opposition to that would be extraordinary.
But it's a policy. Okay. It's unrealistic, but...
I actually, as a policy, I probably wouldn't have a problem with that. But the fight it would cause would just be would be tremendous, and I don't think it could ever politically get
We've had provisional ballots in New York now for 25 years, and in every election there are 20 to 50,000 voters whose provisional ballots are rejected because they're not properly registered. And unless those people are not citizens or are felons, to me it's an embarrassment to the government that those people's ballots were not counted. Technically, the voter, in most of those cases, was at fault for not doing some part of the paperwork. But the bottom line is that they went, they tried to vote, they had the right to vote on a constitutional level, but not on a technical legal basis, because they didn't do something that was required in the registration process. And I don't think that that's a good way to run the government.
Okay, with that thought, we will open it up to questions from the audience. Once I recognize you, if you could tell me who you are and where you're from, and then direct your question to either one of the panelists or to the panel as a whole, that would be delightful. And the first person I spotted was the gentleman in the beard right here. Yes, you.
I'm John DeLuca from Audience in Maryland. Mr. Kellner, during your speech, you said something I found to be rather interesting. I believe what you said was, for every 1,000 people, our voting system does not allow 1,000 people for each fraud that is counted. Is that what you said?
I'm suggesting that the ratio of people whose votes are lost to the number of people who are committing fraud is 1,000 to 1.
Yeah. How do you come up with that calculation? I find that astounding.
Well, it's an admittedly impressionistic calculation. As they say, in New York City, you have 20 to 50,000 votes that are not counted of people who cast provisional ballots, who wanted to, and who are snagged in some way by our registration system. On the other side of that, the number of cases of fraud is very small. But I won't be one of those who say it's non-existent, because I've run into it.
Isn't that just because you're not finding the fraud?
Part of it is that fraud on a retail level, fraud is difficult to do in a way that influences the outcome of elections. Most of the fraud is in small local elections where you can swing an election by a couple of hundred votes or a couple of thousand votes. And it's very hard to do large wholesale fraud without getting caught, because there's so many people involved in that process. And those retail frauds that have come to light show that it's really a minor part of the system. And it's much more significant to me that we're depriving so many people of access to their right to vote in order to catch that small fraud.
Okay, let's see. Jim Bach over there.
Yes, Jim Bach. Jim Bach from Indiana. I'm sorry I can't see the panel from this hole here. But the, I have a question for Wendy about voter ID. And we heard kind of two presenters with their competing studies about the effect of voter ID has had on voter turnout disenfranchisement. But of course, we're all lawyers here, and normally what you do as a lawyer is test those studies in court. You bring a suit like they did, Democrats did in Indiana. You bring a suit, you present your studies, and then they're tested as a matter of law through the evidentiary process. And of course, what was found in the Indiana voter ID case is two things. Number one is that the Democrats study saying that there would be literally hundreds of thousands of voters in Indiana that would be disenfranchised by the law. So it's completely bogus and was rejected by the district court and the Court of Appeals, and as far as I know, by the U.S. Supreme Court. And but then second is that the Democrats could not come up with one single person. In other words, their evidence was hundreds of thousands. They could not come up with one live body of a person that had been that would be disenfranchised. So it seems to me that so my question to Wendy is, were those just a bunch of incompetent Democrat lawyers? Or, I mean, what's the, why is it that once you get to court, there's no proof?
I'm not going to comment on the quality of the litigation in that case, and I'm sorry that the nuns weren't interested in litigating in Indiana. I think, you know, there have been a real dearth of studies and facts on both sides of this issue, and that, you know, there have been a substantial number of studies and surveys on looking at who does have the kinds of voter ID that Indiana wants requires. This is on, typically telephone surveys, but there have been some that have been more extensive, and those were not presented in the litigation. I think that there was an expert witness who did some analysis of the driver's license database using a methodology that the trial court found unreliable. And so there wasn't actually much in the record to base the decision on. And so the trial court was trying to put together some kind of estimate based on nothing. So I think that it is unfortunate that a case with such a slender record is the case that the Supreme Court decided to take, and rather than waiting for this issue to percolate a little bit more, of course, and for more of these studies to not only come forward, but to be tested in court, as you say, and battle for the experts. And,
let's see, Mr. Chance. John Staple, Cato Institute. Question about.
John, people can't hear you. Stand and speak with a loud and moving voice.
I'm not a lawyer. John Samples, the Cato Institute. My question to the panel is, we've heard at various points suggestions that registration problems are at the heart of a lot of various problems. My question is to get your opinion, to what extent did the last big, before HAVA, the last big legislation, voter, to what extent is it at the root of the problem with the registration process in the states now?
I'm going to restate your question because I see
people back there struggling here. I was asking basically, to what extent is voter, the root of the registration problems that are being talked about on the panel?
Anyone
want
to
take
that, Hans?
Don't get me wrong, there's some good things in motor voter. The best thing about the statute was saying that you should be able to register to vote when you go get your driver's license. And that was a very good provision, and it's something that now the overwhelming majority of Americans take advantage of. That's how they get registered to vote. the worst thing about the statute was mail-in voter registration, which allows you to get registered to vote without any election official ever seeing you or verifying that you're a real person. And the restrictions that it put on being able to purge ineligible voters. Now, the statute said that states have to do general list maintenance, which means they're supposed to do general maintenance of the list to get rid of ineligible voters. But the rules they put in were, frankly, so difficult to follow that when they passed the law in 93, a lot of states just quit doing it. They quit doing it because it was so difficult and because they were very scared that they would get sued by the Justice Department for not following the rules correctly. The result of that, you can read in the Crawford case. Indiana pretty much quit doing it. In the Crawford case, the Supreme Court recognized that 41% of the voter registration list for the entire state was ineligible voters. You know, duplicates, people who had died, people who had moved out because they weren't cleaning up the list. And that, I think, has caused extraordinary problems. There are still states around the country, Missouri is another one, where the number of registered voters is not only higher than the number of eligible voters the census says live there, but are significantly higher. I mean, there's counties in Missouri where they have 130-140% registration list in comparison to what census says they actually have. But that's a key indication of problems with the registration list.
Yeah, I'd like to respond. I don't believe that the voter voter law is the source of the problems, but I do want to respond to a point about the mail-in voter registration. And the loophole that Hans referring to about registering by mail, never being seen or verified by an election official, and then requesting an absentee ballot and voting by mail again so that you can never be seen, it's actually one that's been substantially closed now by the Help America Vote Act. You now have to, if you're a first-time voter, to register by mail. You have to either have one of these database matches or show some form of identification. Some states actually have an in-person voting requirement for those first-time voters who register by mail, precisely to address that question. Mere fact that mail-in voter registration doesn't create that situation. And mail-in voter registration was one of the things that was significantly expanded on voter registration, especially in poor communities and in places where people don't typically have driver's licenses. As for the inflated voter rolls, which is true, and I'm going to let Doug address this point, much of that inflation has absolutely nothing to do with the voter laws. The states have not been engaging in list maintenance. There are actually quite limited protections against purges in the voter law, protection against systematic purges within 90 days of an election, and then protection for purges based on movers, people who move because of the errors in actually identifying movers. You have to keep them on the rolls for two federal elections after sending them a certain notice, and if they don't show up to vote, then you can purge them. Those are the first protections, and they're not accounting for dead people on the rolls or other list information.
And with that, let me get the last word, because we are out of time. And my federal society overseers will fire me if I don't keep things on schedule. Now, I want to say that the next panel on election planning and 5.7 will start immediately after we clear the table. So if you need to shuffle around, do it with dispatch. And we will thank you again for listening to us this morning. Thank you.